So welcome. It's an honor and joy to introduce our three teachers, spiritual friends, and authors of Healing Our Way Home, Valerie Brown, Maricela Gomez, and Kyra Jewel Lingo. Valerie Brown is an author, Buddhist Quaker Dharma teacher, facilitator, and executive coach specializing in leadership development and mindfulness practices with a focus on diversity, social equity, and inclusion. Of Afro-Cuban descent, Valerie is a member of the Religious Society of Friends, Quakers, and lives and tends a lively perennial home garden in New Hope, Pennsylvania. Maricela Gomez is a mindfulness teacher in the tradition of Thich Nhat Hanh's Order of Interbeing, public health scholar, activist, preventative alternative medicine physician who is deeply involved in social justice activism and community building and research in Baltimore. Maricela co-facilitates mindfulness gatherings with Baltimore and Beyond Mindfulness Community for BIPOC and social activists. And Kyra Jewel Lingo is a Dharma teacher of Black and biracial heritage with a lifelong interest in spirituality and social justice. After living as an ordained nun for 15 years in Thich Nhat Hanh's monastic community, Kyra Jewel is now based in New York and teaches internationally in the Zen lineage and the Vipassana tradition, as well as in secular mindfulness at the intersection of racial, climate, and social justice, with a focus on activists, Black, Indigenous, and people of color, artists, educators, families, and youth. So we're so delighted to be here today and have the gift of this next hour together. And we'd like to invite each author to read a portion of your book, choosing a portion that feels most relevant to these times, and the invitation is to share why. So thank you so much, Michelle, bowing out.
Maricela, you know what I'm going to say. Please go.
Maricela bowing in, yeah, there's this thing with when the three of us are together, Valerie always asks me if I would like to go. And then I turn around and I see Kyra Jewel's hand is on the book. And so I'm wondering, Kyra Jewel, if this is a better time for you to go or I can go.
Maybe, yes. Bowing in. So good to be with you. Thank you so much, Marcella and BBMC Sangha, for hosting. Are you all able to hear me okay?
Kyra Jewel, you're breaking up a lot. I'm wondering.
Can folks hear? Can you put your thumb up if you can hear me?
You're breaking up a lot. So maybe you might want to go off camera and only
Can
use
you
the
hear
mic.
me? No?
That's better
Oh.
without the audio. Kyra Jewel, we can hear you. It's just breaking up, and without the audio,
Off
maybe.
camera. Okay.
Yes, exactly, with just the audio. Thank you.
Is this better? Oh, good. Okay. Okay, great. My apologies. Okay. So with just the audio, so is it clear now? Can you hear me well? Okay. I was just saying how wonderful it is to get to be here with you all, and a deep thank you to Marisela and to the BBMC Sangha for organizing this event. Maybe someone else should go first.
Marisol bowing in, thank you. Yes, Karujul, I can go ahead and go, and maybe you can figure out that reception. Thank you, Valerie. Thank you, Karujul. It's always a very deep pleasure and joy and honor to be together again. And thank you, all the folks here, again, also like Karujul, seeing many faces and names that are I recognize and hold in my heart. Thank you, Tai, dear Tai. Without you, we wouldn't be here because you brought us together. And thank you, all the ancestors who brought us here, ones more recent and the ones from thousands of years now. So the question was a reading from a place in the book that we each felt relevant for these times. And honestly, there's a lot of places in the book that offer for me relevance to what these days and times that we're in. So I chose one, and I'll share that and then share why I think so. So if you have the book in front of you and you want to follow along, you don't have to, but you can just close your eyes and listen. I'm on page 172. And we are in a conversation, it's the last chapter, and we're sort of, it's a different chapter than the previous ones, where it's more organized, where there's a question and we all respond to the question, and we're kind of respond to each other as in our it's a conversation, really. It's a dialogue. In this last part, in this last chapter, we called it "Don't Get Me Started" because we started talking about something and it just went. It had its own rhythm. It had its own energy. And so it's the only chapter in the book where it's more of a engaged back and forth dialogue. It's not one person sharing for a period and then another person sharing to the same theme. The chapter is "Don't Get Me Started: Real Talk on Race and Truly Coming Home to Ourselves," and page 172. So I'm responding to some back and forth that Valerie and I have been having around how, as Black folks and folks of color, we show up in places, and sometimes how we don't show up in our full selves, and why that is from this history of oppression. So I'll go to the book. But I'm speaking here about how we've come into our sense of being. I've come into my sense of being from feeling inferior, from feeling not enough, from feeling like I have no self-worth. Coming from that to feeling now, I couldn't care less what people think about me. I see the world in a very different way. I don't need people to affirm me or make me feel like I deserve to be on this planet. I am here and that's it, right? My value is not relative to whiteness or blackness or brownness or anyoneness anymore. So we, as people of color, we find a spiritual path and we begin to discover ways out of how we were brought up. I now see my power, right? But so many white people, they've gotten their power from our having less power, their status from our being lower than them. Tay's teaching of, quote, you're like that because I'm like this, and I'm like this because you're like that, close quote, is powerful and real. It's as if those who benefit from whiteness were born right into power because of the presence and oppression of Black people or BIPOC people, Black Indigenous people of color. This is as regards their identity relative to others in the world. They didn't have the suffering we Black folks have had. And maybe this is the depth of the Dharma. They didn't have the suffering to figure out their real worth. They are missing the mud of racial inferiority that can grow the lotus of self-love and acceptance. We have this suffering and a process of peaceful understanding of our power, granted over time and much suffering. Not having that, I think, has been a disservice to so many white people. Now I'm looking long-term, when a white population realizes that they've built their sense of self, their sense of who they are as beings based on a superiority complex. What happens when that breaks apart? So, of course, whiteness cannot handle that because it hasn't always had to, so the skills are not there. So many who identify as white would not be able to handle this truth, this corruption of the foundations of their values, like what happened with the opioid epidemic in the early 2000s. We saw this explosion of opioid use in the white population at the end of the housing fiasco. White people turned to drug use to numb themselves from the housing crisis and its resulting poverty. That's a really good example of what happens when white people lose status due to poverty. They find their perspective on them, of themselves deflated, and they don't know what to do. So what do they do in this instance? Like many, they turn to something to numb their pain, to escape it. I think there's this way where the suffering in the skin, in this skin, in all my identities, and the way I've grown up, and the strife I've faced has really transformed something in me that isn't based on being better than anybody, right? There's something to that suffering. For me, that's why Dharma is so deep, because there is something that comes out of the suffering that really makes you different. This practice is one of pausing and looking deeply. Why? To see what is there, to understand how and why the suffering has come about, and to find a path away from it that is healing. And there's a practice pause right here, so I invite us to practice now, as it shares in the book. So we can begin by allowing ourselves to take a deep breath in. Maybe close your eyes, or if you're not able to, go ahead and take a deep breath in. And let it out with a sigh as you exhale. And then continue this breathing in stillness. Breathing in, and then breathing out, touching that ground under your body that supports you. Breathing in the freshness of the blue sky, or maybe the gray sky, depending on where you are. And breathing out and become rerooted to the earth, reconnected to the earth. That's really always there for us. Breathing in the calm and the ease. And breathing out, connecting to ancestors and to wisdom. We'll just take another breath in and out, feeling our calmness, our self-calm, our ability to self-soothe. So thank you for listening. And for me, this this speaks to what is happening now. We are in a tumultuous time in the world, in the United States. There's a sense of fear in the white body, the population in large, of losing something, which is what I'm speaking of in the book. What happens when what we're used to, the foundational premise of who we are in a society, starts to shift? What happens when we walk into a store or a rest stop, a travel stop, which is where I like to do this practice, and you look around in that stop, and it's not a majority white faces and bodies in that stop anymore, like it might have been 30, 40, 50 years ago, even 20 years ago. When you look around in a rest stop, like when I travel from here up to New York or Baltimore to New York, it's a majority BIPOC face and bodies, all shapes and sizes, beautiful, right? But what happens when a white population that's used to seeing themselves reflected everywhere in the majority, what happens when that starts to shift? It's like a seismic shift, like almost like the earth is shifting under. And without a practice to help understand that who a person has identified themselves as has been relative to a Black person or a BIPOC person, it's really hard. Whereas for Black and BIPOC people, we've been reared in order to be safe to always keep in mind that we're relative to whiteness in order to be alive and to be safe. And for our ancestors, even more so, depending on where we came from. And so now we're in a different time, and this time, the politics that we're in, the hatred that is just spewing out everywhere, has a lot to do with the shifting and the disability of people, of white people used to seeing themselves in a privileged space, just questioning what will happen to me now. Who am I if I am not the one in power? And that's what I speak up. This is what this is speaking to. And that conversation really is a very deep dive into the need to really pause and take a breath for all of us, and to not lose, because the earth is shifting beneath us, not go to hatred, but go to understanding and look really deep to understand how we've come to be who we are. So I'll stop there. Thank you for your listening. I'll invite Valerie if she would like to continue on.
Dear Ty, dear beloved community, dear Maricela, thank you so much for the sharing. And please give your my best to your mom. I wish I was there eating her food. I was going to ask you, what are you having for dinner? But don't rub it in. I'm sure whatever it is, it's going to be good. And dessert will be part of that. But I so appreciate and so love you, and I'm so grateful, really, truly, for having you and Karjul and everyone who is here on this call, people I've known and learned from for many, many, many years. I was just thinking, Maricela, as you were speaking, it's actually 30 years ago this year that I first came in contact with Thich Nhat Hanh. It was 1994. I was very much ensconced in my big lawyer job. And I've told a story in the book, attending his public talk and walking out of the talk hours later thinking, this isn't for me. No. because if this person is right, then everything that I scaffolded, and everything that I built up, that it would have to be deconstructed. And guess what? I'm still deconstructing. It's like a never-ending task. So it's really a great honor to be here and to share. The book is a manifestation of the friendship, the spiritual friendship between the three of us. And I thought I would sh share a part of the book. If you have the book, it's page 120. I'm a very practical person, and so I want to share a part of the book that goes to our practice and the fruit of the practice. And really, that to me points to not only the portability of mindfulness, how we can receive these practices, these teachings, and apply it to our daily life. That's really the key here. These gems, the jewels of the practice, and we apply them to the daily life. So here's an example of that. The application of the practice in daily life. Sorry, page 121. I can offer a specific example from my everyday life about how I bridge the gap between my study of mindfulness and the application of mindfulness in real life. Most mornings, I have the practice of some kind of high-intensity interval training or physical exercise. This particular day, I was running up a hill. I ran up as fast as I could, and I got to the top of the hill. I had about 10 seconds of rest when a white woman started walking toward me with a leash in her hand and said, "If you see a dog, it's mine." And I said to her out of breath, "Oh, I don't live here." And then she said, "Well, okay, bitch." Just like that, she said it flat out. And the old me, the Brooklyn badass New Yorker me, part of me, which is still there, would have stopped, gone up to her in an aggressive way, like, "You want to get it on?" But because I've been conditioned to stop, to pause, to take a breath, I was able to notice what was happening and not react out of aggression, I should say. I did react. I literally felt the fire come up through my stomach into my face like a flash of lightning. And I just stopped. I took a breath. I noticed, wow, my conditioned reaction would have been to want to beat this person. I walked away from her thinking, wow, what the hell's the matter with her? Not reacting to her. And in a split second, I was like, that's a victory. I didn't have to react in hatred to her stuff. I didn't have to take that on. I could be clean. I didn't have to take on her dirtiness. I didn't have to make her dirtiness my dirtiness. That was a victory for me. I realized after I settled down that this person was suffering, and I even felt compassion for her. And that's just one example of realizing that this stuff we call mindfulness works. So, yeah, let me just read that last paragraph because I think it's important too. I could have done this on my own. I could not have done this on my own without a community of practice. If I had not had could I have done this on my own without a community of practice if I had not had a mindfulness practice at all? Well, I'm not sure. Probably not. Because my childhood was loaded with fear and a lot of violence growing up. And I learned that when somebody fights you, you fight them back, period. But through the practice, I learned a different way to respond. So that's one simple example of one thing that happened to me. It's not easy. And I guess the point that I really want to make here is the power of community in all of this, that this is not the victory or the triumph of one individual, but because there is interbeing, because we're connected, that this is the fruit of the practice, and we can't do this alone. It really does take a sangha. So I think the paragraph, kind of the reading, the excerpt really speaks for itself. And I'm really happy if folks have questions or want to talk about it to engage. So Valerie bowing out. Thank you for listening so much.
Thank you so much, Valerie. Just checking in. Can folks hear me now? Can you hear well? Okay,
yes.
Great. Okay. So sorry for the connection difficulties. I'm calling in from JFK Airport. But I am so, so grateful to be here with all of you. I want to express the same joy and deep gratitude that Maricela and Valerie have shared, that you all are taking this time to be here and to go deep into the journey of this book with us. And I've been very moved and appreciative of the two readings and the meditation that have been shared thus far. So I had actually chosen a reading that's just after what Valerie read. I'm sure no coincidence, but I just opened to this. I was like, oh, this is what I want to read to you. So it's page 123. I won't read the first paragraph, which explains the four chairs exercise. I think it will be clear when I read the story, but it's the paragraph that starts towards the end of page 123. So, and apologies for the background noise. I hope you can still hear me okay with with all the other noise. Okay. So, just a brief backstory. Richard Brady and I were teaching a retreat for educators, and he shared a nonviolent communication activity where you go back and choose a time of hurt, or someone said something to you that was hurtful, and you put yourself in four different chairs to respond to this person's hurt. So when he introduced this exercise, the moment of hurt that I chose was when I was 18 years old, and I had just spent a month volunteering in a rural village in the north of Portugal, and I was getting on a train to return to Lisbon. I was putting my bags in a pretty tight luggage compartment, and to make space, I had to move other people's luggage. I could see that people near the luggage area were watching me closely and not so happy that I was rearranging bags. As I passed by them to get to my seat, this older white Portuguese man hissed at me in Portuguese, saying, "Morena que não presta para nada," which means, "Brown woman, you're worth nothing," or "You're no good." I was in shock, and my first thought was, that didn't really happen. Part of me just couldn't take it in. But then when I got to my seat and had a chance to really feel it, to take it in, I thought, he actually said that to me. And I felt so many emotions, fear, rage, sadness. But mostly I felt frozen, humiliated, and shut down. And I wondered, what should I do? Should I go back and yell at him, defend myself? I was a teenager in a foreign country, and this guy was in his 50s or 60s. I never did go back and say anything to him, but it really hurt, and that experience stayed lodged in me, still unhealed. So this incident popped into my mind for the four chairs exercise after many years of not thinking about it. I still felt that frozen, horrible hurt and rage that didn't have a way to be expressed at the time. It was beautiful in this retreat to go through the four chairs exercise and let all the anger come out toward him in the first chair, which I'd never allowed myself to do before. I wrote down what I would have said if I were coming from a rageful and offended place. And then the second chair was where we take the blame. That was powerful too. My mind went to, oh, I must have done something wrong. It must be my fault that he spoke to me in this way. Then with the third chair, I could hold my own dismay and heartbreak. So the third chair is where we turn compassion towards ourselves in a moment of being hurt by someone's words. It was a deeply disempowering experience to be spoken to that way. How could someone say that to me? How could they possibly think that? I knew I didn't deserve that. In the fourth and final chair, I tried to touch what it must be like, what you would have had to feel like inside to say something so degrading to a young person whom you know nothing about, just based on their skin color. The way that meanness corrodes your heart and the low self-worth he may have felt for himself to be looking at others in such a flattened, myopic way. I had spent the summer in service to poor rural Portuguese farmers, but to him, I was not a real person. It was really powerful to allow all of those parts of myself to speak and to be heard. There was a kind of knot that was in me from so many years ago that had this moment to be released. I was able to see the whole situation for the first time, both what was happening for me, but also what might have been happening for him. And this whole white supremacist culture that we live in that infects and warps our minds. I appreciated the exercise because it demonstrates what Thay teaches, that if you dwell deeply in the present, you can go back and heal the past. It was cathartic to go through all four chairs, and their order is significant. You can't skip over the anger, the desire to judge and retaliate. You have to let that out so you can metabolize and compost the pain. I hadn't realized the memory had lodged like a dagger in me because I never processed it. This exercise helps us to detonate the bombs in us, to go back and bring up painful stuff and process it so that it's no longer making us unconsciously reactive. So thank you for listening to that story. And I'll just share a few more thoughts on why I chose this for these times. I've been just reflecting on this moment historically in our country and the world of so much polarization, and especially so many hurtful words, so many insulting, thinking about Kamala Harris, the new presidential candidate, all the insults we've been hearing that are pouring out about her being a DEI hire, and code words, But just the power of this practice to help us to not be reactive in the ways that both Valerie and Maricela have spoken not to not be reactive, but to experience our reactivity and to work with it in a more conscious way. I think that fourth chair of coming to the place where we try to put ourselves in the shoes of the other person saying whatever hurtful thing they're saying connects back to what you were speaking to, Maricela, of the ways we're all wounded by this system that's just absolute lie that is in the very DNA of our culture, of our constitution, of our whole global society, that some people are worthy of being human and others are not. And that really harms all of us. And so the more we can go into this election season with the all four chairs capacity in us, I think the more skillful we can be as practitioners in this time. Thank you so much for listening. Hope you could hear me okay. Hi, Rajul, bowing out.
Agatha bowing in. Hello and welcome. My name is Agatha So. My pronouns are she, her, and hers. I'm also a member of the Baltimore and Beyond Sangha here in the land of the Piscataway, Lummi, and other peoples. Really feels wonderful to be here with all of you, and want to express my gratitude and appreciation for the three authors and teachers here for sharing a piece and a moment from the book that they collaborated and created together, and for creating this shared space today. We are going to transition to some questions. We do have time for a few questions. We have received some questions from the attendees ahead of time, and we'll try to address those questions first. In the meantime, if there are questions, perhaps burning in your mind that you're anxious to share, we definitely invite you to share them one of two ways. First, you can actually write the question in the chat. So feel free to, write your question in. Perhaps as we are going to be going through the questions, again, we'll begin with a couple of questions that we received from our attendees, in advance. And then if we have time, we'll move into a couple of questions from the attendees. The second way of asking a question, so if you would like to try and have your question answered and we'd like to share it in person, I would just ask that you raise your hand and we will try to call on you in the order in which your hand appears. So again, either feel free to type your question in the chat if possible, just please wait until we've addressed some of the questions we've already received, and then feel free to raise your hand and we will call on you to unmute and ask your question. So thank you very much. I see a question already in the in the chat. We'll get to that towards the end of our time together. But for now, I want to share a few questions. The invitation here is for all three authors, all three teachers, to respond to each question. If you so choose, you may choose to pass if it's not a question you wish to respond to. But the invitation is open to the three of you. So the first question is, what would you say to an activist or organizer who thinks that healing is something you do only in the wake of an individual's experience, for instance, therapy to address depression or relationship issue, and not a deeper ongoing practice, for instance, that addresses racism, socialization, and embodied healing?
Marisol, bowing in, I'm happy to contribute to this question and invite others, my friends here on the path, to do the same. So as an activist and an organizer, it's a great question. What's healing got to do with it, especially I think as a person is asking, and maybe if you can put it in the chat, Agatha, so others can see it as well and appreciate it, that'd be great. Yeah, thank you. The idea that we can do the work of social change and social justice without healing is it's not sustainable. I've learned this from my own practice, having been doing justice work and activism and organizing work for some good more than 30 years, where in the previously, before I started practicing mindfulness in this way, I didn't think that healing, I thought healing was separate. Just like the question said, you go over there and you do your healing with the therapist, and I did that, right? Many years of that one-on-one healing with the therapist. And then you go into the work of the organizing and the justice work, yeah? And they were the same. And yet, what I learned is that the way I show up in the justice work has everything to do with how I am and how I'm taking care of my traumas and my lack of healing, or so how I'm healing. So how does that specifically show up? It shows up within a meeting of organizers. It could show up as an inability to listen to others, or when someone offers another way than your way, and you feel like that person is egotistical because they're offering something else. That could really be my pain that I'm holding, my inability to listen to others, my fear of losing control because I've been historically oppressed and not had control. I might receive someone who is an ally, right, who is in the same struggle and for justice with me. I may not be able to hear and listen to what they're offering, in a particular strategy of how we might do the work, simply because I'm still holding in me this tension, this unhealed injury around being controlled.
Really?
So it's so direct, right? It's my ability to be open, to be spacious, to be able to listen deeply has everything to do with how much space I have inside of me. And my suffering doesn't allow the spaciousness to be there, any of the suffering, right? So this continued healing, even in these spaces, so what does that look like? Well, I'll tell you, in Valar, Village of Love and Resistance, the social justice organization I'm deeply involved in every meeting we do a grounding at the beginning. Whichever the meeting is, if it's with architects, if it was lawyers, if it's with whoever it is, members, we do a grounding. We invite everyone to share a grounding. Everyone has an opportunity to be co-leading the space. And we come back to the present moment so that we can be fully present for what's coming up and for each other. And that's an ongoing practice. That's not only one time. And we're aware that there's so much trauma, generational trauma, that needs to be healed, especially in some of the communities that I'm in, which are historically Black, marginalized communities, redline communities, communities that have gone through urban renewal, continue to go through gentrification, people living in public housing who continue to be discriminated against because they live in public housing. So the trauma is not just historical, it's ongoing. And so this work, when we're working for justice in all these spaces, whichever it is, racial, gender justice, environmental justice, immigrant justice, it requires the acknowledgement that we are all in this process of healing from the suffering that we're trying to address. So just because we're able to deal with it publicly in that kind of external activist forum, it doesn't mean that we have taken care of it internally, right? Because as activists, sometimes what draws us to activism is we know what it feels like to be marginalized. We know what it feels like deep in our bones, in our heart, in our soul to be oppressed, but not just us, our parents, our grandparents, generational. We have it in us, right? And so we want it to change. And sometimes we go external and we forget the internal. So the long-term sustainability of any justice struggle, of any struggle or work for change requires that we are really clear on what we're bringing into the circle. And that means what's been healed and what hasn't been healed and what's in process of healing. This embodied healing, this understanding of how we show up has everything to do with how we're healing. And it's one of the reasons of Volar, one of our main part of our mission is healing, because we know that we can transform a lot of properties. But if the people aren't healed, then there's still so much missing for it to be long-term and sustainable. So that's a part of the response, and I invite Valerie and Karjul, if you'd like to respond as well. Thank you for going out.
Dear Thay, dear community, this is Valerie bowing in. So want to go in a tiny different, in a little bit of a different direction with the beautiful question. And thank you so much for asking this question. It really does go to the heart of the book. In some ways, particularly in the United States, mindfulness as a path of healing has become commodified, transactional. Like, I got my mindfulness, I got my healing, and so you people, well, too bad, you know. And so this kind of rugged individualism, taking the kind of corruption that we see individualism run rampant, has been translated into the practice of mindfulness, you know, and for many people. And what that does, of course, is misunderstand the Sangha and the nature of interbeing, that healing is not a one person job, that it takes a community, because we cannot be separated, right? So we all know that. And the other thing that I would point to is in the educational space, there's a saying, something like from our teacher, happy teachers will change the world. You could modify that and say happy activists, happy organizers will change the world. And so this change, if the change that we want to see is racial healing, social justice healing, whatever the healing, whatever the change is, the growth is, the thing is that we are seeking, that, as Marcella was saying, and as we all know, begins from a cultivation of from within. And, you know, Ty would often talk about the caricature of the angry peace activist, the person who would fight and kill for peace. It's a deformation. And so we know this. And so it is the work of yes, healing ourselves, like putting our oxygen mask on first, not in a narcissistic way, but because we know that as I get a little bit clearer, a little bit freer, a little bit more myself, as I love myself and hold myself with greater self-love and respect, I can translate and do that for other people. And by its nature, it's going to affect the work that we do. And I speak about this in the book as a lobbyist. I changed from within, and that changed the way I was working. So we teach, we become who we are, and that's a beautiful thing. So it's a work in progress. It's not complete, and the main point here is recognizing that this is something that comes from within, and we share that with other people, right? And that the nature of this isn't just my individual healing, and you folks get your own healing in your own way. That obviously feeds polarization, which is rampant in our culture now. So I'll stop there. And again, thank you for the very important question. Valerie bowing out.
Thank you so much, Valerie, Maricela. Checking that you can still hear well. Okay. I'll try to answer briefly because I know we just have, I think, 15 more minutes. I just want to share a story of how this has been true for me, how important it is the way we do things, in an activist situation, in any effort to change how things are. And it was the experience of being invited to be on a panel to raise awareness in Dharma communities about what's happening in Gaza, and to really make a firm take a firm stand that being silent is really not doing our Buddha Dharma justice. Like, that's not the teachings in this moment to remain silent. And it was really kind of the first time I had been in a public way in that kind of, I guess I'll just say I had felt kind of in private conversations, you know, a lot of, you know, many people that I would speak to were very on the same page that what was happening was wrong, that our government's support of what was happening in Gaza you know, funding genocide was wrong. But I hadn't had a very clear way to be public about that, because I felt pretty isolated with so many of our Buddhist institutions remaining quite silent. And across different traditions. And so what was so powerful for me being invited to be on this panel, where people shared very powerfully, very strongly. There was a Palestinian journalist who lives in Jerusalem who spoke, an Israeli practitioner who also lives, I think, in Jerusalem also spoke, plus a number of Dharma teachers and practitioners living in the West. And we started, we had a meeting beforehand where there was a lot of care to just really hold people wherever they were, a lot of respect. We met just before we went on and just really offered each other a lot of kindness, a lot of support. And then after we shared on the panel, we also stayed on the Zoom and spoke and just held each other in this very kind and tender way for like another hour. And there were tears and there was just deep siblinghood. And it was so powerful to me to feel like we could do this thing that was in some sense, you know, challenging. Well, for me, it was challenging. And to feel that it, you know, that I had so much support and that there was such truth being told. And it was painful, you know, to hear the ways in which our own community, our own communities across different traditions it's confusing, right? The way that we're not able to just have a clear message in this moment. And so, I felt like the embrace of the community really helped me find my voice. And for me, that's an example of it's a kind of response to this question of why it's so important that we are deeply connected to our hearts when we take action on behalf of the whole. Otherwise we go, you know, very quickly into blame, shame, othering, and rather than gathering friends and people who at least are open to listening to us, even if they disagree with us, we alienate each other and we weaken our movements, we weaken our communities. So that's just a recent example for me. And if any of you want to hear that panel, which I would encourage you to do, it's through the Sacred Mountain Sangha and Tanisara's community, Sacred Justice Coalition as well. It's on YouTube. But Bhikkhu Bodhi has a beautiful reflection there. Anyway, I encourage you to watch it if you haven't. So I would just like to offer that as a concrete example of how the two, inner healing and outer healing, absolutely go together. And also to say that the inner healing is not an excuse to not do the outer healing, right? That saying, well, we really need to take, you know, make sure that we're coming from a peaceful place. That doesn't mean then that we don't take action, right? That it's really on both fronts that we need to be addressing. But when we do take care of our hearts, of our relationships, of our language, of how we communicate, it's much easier to take action out in the world, and to actually sustain ourselves through that. 'Cause it's hard, right? If we have a community where there's love, where there's understanding, where there's compassion, it's much easier to keep going when you're up against something, you know, really difficult and longstanding. So I'll stop there. Thank you so much for the question, Kyra Jewel, bowing out.
Thank you. To all our teachers, we really appreciate you sharing such really thoughtful responses with us. We It looks like we are running a little short on time. So I was wondering if the three teachers with us today would be willing to respond to the two other questions that we received over email and perhaps share it with the group. I'm assuming that we do have the contacts for everyone who joined, but want to just double check to see if our teachers and our authors would be amenable. I see Maricela saying yes, and Valerie, thank you, and Kyra, thank you. Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. We also want to be mindful and mindful of everyone's time, but also grateful for your time. We do have a short closing, but thank you again for your time today sharing. Agatha bowing out.
Dear beautiful people, beautiful community, my name is Victoria Masisa. My pronouns are she, sha, and we. And sha is non-gendered reflection pronoun in the Tagalog language of the Philippine Islands, currently named, colonized name of the Philippine Islands. And I'm honored to offer a short closing and really want to invite all of you who, you know, to purchase the book if you haven't yet. It's a beautiful book. There's many beautiful resources in it. You can purchase it wherever books are sold. And from a personal perspective, as I was reading it, I was just so moved and touched by such beautiful personal sharings and connections and wisdom. And today it continued with our beautiful time together. I feel like this last question is like, oh, that's just a beginning. We wish to hear more. So many pearls of wisdom today. So thanking all of you to be here, and I'm so honored to be here as well. So as was invited at the very beginning, inviting you to just take a pause and get comfortable as we close this beautiful time together, beautiful wisdom and vulnerability and encouragement for our inner healing and our outer healing so that we can offer ourselves to the world and the healing. So inviting you just to get comfortable and as we reflect on the teachings and the energies of our time together, may we gather all of this beautiful energy, our ancestors who are here with us, our ancestors who have guided us and continue to guide us, these teachings and this wisdom that continue to guide us. Let us gather this energy together. May the fruits of all of this energy and the benefits of all of this energy, may we hold it and also send it out to the world. May it touch all those who touch us. And may it touch all those who are suffering, all those who may be in conflict, or all the places in the world who are in conflict. May it just touch all those communities. May this time together remain in our hearts and in our spirits, offering peace, joy, and liberation to all. Thank you, dear beautiful people. Perhaps we wish to unmute, offer each other beautiful hearts and care.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, dear siblings. It was a beautiful presentation.
Love to you all.
Thank you all. Be well.
Thank you for being here, Mitchell. It's so good to see you, Nia.
Yes.
Good
to see you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Mitchell.
Travel safely, Karajul.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody. Much care and love.
Take good care. Much love.
Give our love to your mom.
Yes. Enjoy New Orleans and Bayano. Thanks for hosting us.